You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Hi, everyone. My name is Daniel Wolf, and I'm the director of the Harm Reduction Program. And I'm pleased to welcome you, and especially pleased to welcome Mark Gavisser, who's our speaker today. Mark is an acclaimed journalist and has published in venues as various as the New York Times, Foreign Affairs, South African venue, Rand Daily Mail, is that where you used to
be? The Mail and Guard.
The Mail and Guard, The Nation, The Village Voice, back when The Village Voice was a paper of substance in New York. He is an accomplished biographer, most notably of the former South African president, Thabo Mbeki. He is a great cultural critic and analyst. He is an activist. And more recently, and to the point, he is an OSF fellow. And we are going to hear from him today about some of his work that looks at sexuality, particularly bisexual, lesbian, and gay sexuality, and gender, particularly what we would call transgender, although I think he might complicate that a little bit for us, and the intersection of local policy and practice and what we in public health might call international vectors, although it sounds ominous and contagious. Maybe Mark would call them flows, but basically global flows, whether that's of ideas and ideologies, for example, human rights, or whether that's of people, for example, mass migration and urbanization, or whether that's of information, for example, through the internet age. And obviously, these are questions that touch a lot of us in our general work at OSF. And I see representatives from various programs around the room. I don't think we'll take time to introduce everyone now, but there will be a time for question and answers, and it would be helpful, I think, for Mark and for the rest of us if you could, when asking questions, sort of state where you're coming from, you know, what program at OSF you're working with. So I propose that we structure this as a conversation for like 15 or 20 minutes and then open it up for questions. And I guess the first question for me has to do with one of the global flows where we are most engaged or implicated, which is about human rights on the one hand, and particularly gay rights. There has been a lot of attention to what is attention, particularly in Africa, around sort of the export of evangelical right-wing ideology and homophobia on the one hand, and on the other, what you have somewhat naughtily called the missionary position of gay rights advocates who are seeking to export a kind of universal norm of what gay rights should look like. And then, of course, there are the people in Uganda or in Senegal or other places who are sort of in the middle making sense of this. For those of us who are older, this is sort of reminiscent of the culture wars of the 80s, but on a sort of global scale. And I know that you're framing it particularly with an eye toward what it means for sexuality. So what does it mean?
Okay, I mean, maybe the best way into this is to tell you about this document that I just distributed. So this is a summary of a very important meeting that happened in Oslo yesterday in preparation for the Human Rights Council, the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva in June. And it's part of a process of something that's been happening at the United Nations around getting specific about the protection of the rights of LGBT people within the United Nations and applying the Universal Declaration of Human Rights specifically to LGBT people. And it's a process that has a kind of three-year history, and that began with an initiative by South Africa and Brazil, which is very interesting because it didn't come from the global north or the global west, even though it must be said that a lot of strong-arming was done behind the scenes by the United States, and particularly Hillary Clinton and Susan Rice. And it was an initiative to say we need to look at specifically protection of LGBT people. And that led to a report of the High Commissioner of Human Rights and led to an historic debate last year at the Human Rights Council, again hosted by South Africa and Brazil, saying we need to do something about this. And now there's a possibility that there's going to be a special rapporteur on violence against LGBT people appointed by the Human Rights Council. And this was a preliminary meeting of sort of friendly nations to strategize how to go about doing that at the UN. Now, there's a kind of counterforce to that, which is at the same time that this has been happening, like, if you like, using the culture wars analogy, in the blue states. It is the blue states, right? The blue states are
blue states are
democratic.
Us.
Sorry.
I know that they're
no,
not
but
really
I'm gonna get it. I'm gonna get into this us and them in a minute because we are players. We are players in these culture wars. So at the same time as that's happening in the blue states, something's happening in the global red states, led by Russia, and this is a movement to declare that traditional values and cultural sovereignty must limit the rollout of human rights, that these have to be taken into account very seriously. And there was a counter-resolution at the Human Rights Commission, which passed. So you've got these two resolutions which passed in the last year at the Human Rights Commission, which are in opposition to each other, led by these two groups of nations. Obviously the rump of the red states is the Islamic world, but Russia, playing its own sort of new Cold War games, has decided to lead this movement. And I say new Cold War advisedly, because I think it is possible to understand what's happening as a kind of, firstly, as a culture war's gone global, but also as a kind of new sort of Cold War-style proxy war that's playing out between these two sides, sort of on the terrain, on the battlefield, on the bodies of people in the global south. I think it's a way to start, but I think we need to complicate that deeply,
so
which is hopefully what I'm going to do here. But just to finish the sketch, these two sides have shock teams, and the shock teams of the red states are Scott Lively, the people who are promoting family values, the American Christian Right, who pretty much wrote the law in Uganda, the bill in Uganda, the anti-gay law that you all know about. But we are the shock team on the other side, and you particularly.
We OSF, we the human rights
community. We the human rights community, but we/you, specifically OSF, given that OSF has an LGBTI rights campaign, has SHARP, has all this programming that is very deliberate, along with, you know, the Nordic countries and organizations like HIVAS, along with other foundations that do philanthropic work, is very doggedly and specifically setting up, if you like, or enabling kind of human rights outposts in these countries where these conflicts have begun, by capacitating human rights defenders and human rights advocates. So this is a kind of a global dynamic that I think is really important to understand, and I think that we can complicate in many ways, and hopefully we will today.
So one complication or question, because in that story of the sort of clashing global actors, the global south, or you know, I don't know how, whatever you want to call it, but I know that you have been, for example, in the course of your fellowship already to Philippines, to India, to Senegal, and unfortunately Sharp and, like, Michael is not with us, and Sharp also has Sharp has a competing event, but actually we have a representative from Sharp here who works specifically on trans rights issues and health issues. But I guess the question is, I don't think that many of our partners would like to be portrayed just as passive recipients of these flows that wash over them, and they are empty vessels waiting to be filled by our insights or that of the red team.
Right.
I don't know how much chance you've had to reflect on the kind of the local interaction with these forces and sort of local agency.
Right. I mean, I was deliberately setting that up crudely, because that is, of course, how the the red team sees us. Uh-huh. And that's how we see the red team. And perhaps I can answer that question by reporting back on a meeting that I convened in Washington, D.C. for OSF together with the Human Rights Campaign and the Coalition for Global Equality, which does lobbying work on LGBT issues in the American government. And this was a meeting called the Global Export of Homophobia. And it was specifically a convening of anybody working in the field of looking at how the American religious right is exporting homophobia to the developing world. And we sat in this meeting, and the person who led this meeting is an extraordinary man, a Zambian cleric by the name of Kapya Kawama, who works for Political Research Associates, and who's written who's broken the story on how the American Christian right is fomenting homophobia in sub-Saharan Africa, written two really powerful reports that I urge you to read. One is called Globalizing Culture Wars. The first one is called Globalizing Culture Wars, exactly this theory. And Kapya, as an African, as a non-homosexual African, speaks very powerfully about homophobia, about how homophobia is a Western import, imported through two waves of missionary activity. The first being the sort of late Victorian 19th century colonial missionary activity, and the second wave, of course, being what we're experiencing now with the likes of Scott Lively. And there were some African participants at that meeting, LGBT human rights defenders who live and work in Africa, who took great exception to the sketch and who said, this kind of sketch denies us our own agency. We are capable of our own homophobic actions in Africa. We have had homophobic actions way before the advent of colonial, even though it was colonization that brought the penal code and the anti-sodomy legislation. There have been ways that gender non-normative people have both been accepted and rejected in pre-colonial societies all over the world. Accept that. And one of the participants, a man named Joel Nana, who is a recipient of OSF funding, said, if you're going to say that Pastor Martin Semper, who is the most homophobic Ugandan preacher, is nothing but an agent or a puppet of right-wing Americans, then you could say exactly the same thing about me, because, you know, I learned so much of what I know by working for IGLHRC, the International Lesbian and Gay Human Rights Council. But I've taken that and indigenized it. You know, we are all Afropolitan, we are all global citizens, we all work with pastiche. Let's not be essentialist about this. And I think that agency point is a really important one to understand. But I think what's also important to understand, if one's going to accept that point, is the way and this is maybe a little bit more contentious, but I think really important, is the way the LGBT paradigm is a Western paradigm, mm-hmm. that emerges out of a very specific set of economic and political circumstances going back a decade. And we can talk about, a century. Mm-hmm. And we can talk about that. So there has always been homosexuality in all cultures. There has always been gender non-normativity in all cultures. This notion of sexual minorities, of people claiming rights on the basis of an identity rather than a behavior, is something that has developed through capitalist society and through liberal democracy. And therefore, whether one is Joel Nana himself, whether one is somebody who is from the global Southeast countries in places other than North America or Western Europe, or whether it's us, one needs to understand the implications of that. I mean, it doesn't mean to say that the notion of human rights are foreign to Uganda or the Philippines, but there is a whole kind of cultural, economic, political genealogy that needs to be understood if people are going to be able to claim their rights as they want to and as we want them to.
So a question about the indigenized version, because I mean, one thing that you're saying is that actors who identify as In the example you used as gay, but I assume as L or G or B or T.
Well, very few people identify as B.
B is a separate question, and perhaps we will should bracket that.
And we're not even talking about I.
No, and we've left off I. I wonder if you have in your travels encountered groups that constitute themselves around a sexual identity that actually isn't the Western series of initials, but is something, I don't want to say in between, but just not on that grid. So you know that people like the author of Desiring Arabs,
Joseph Massad,
has been very critical of what he sees as the rush to force people actually into kind of identities that are focused on single object choice. Like, you know, you have to be, you're either gay or you're straight, or there are people who I might identify as something on the trans continuum that wouldn't identify as trans because there's a cultural context. I know that you have been traveling.
This is something I'm particularly interested in understanding, and perhaps is most interesting to track in the Asian context, where there's a tradition of gender fluidity. So I can give a few examples. For me, one that's clearest in my mind, because I've been there most recently, is I was in the Philippines, where there's something extraordinary political happening at the moment. The Philippines has a very, after the People's Power Revolution of the late 80s, has a constitution and an electoral system which allows you to vote twice. The first time you vote in a district, and the second time you vote for a special interest group in a proportional representation system. Mm-hmm. And traditionally, those special interest groups have been women, agrarians, taxi drivers, ethnic minorities. But the LGBT movement there has applied for the right to form a political party so that they could also be a special interest group. They were denied that right by the Electoral Commission for moral reasons, but they challenged it at the Supreme Court. They won, and they're contesting this election in a campaign that the party's called Ang Ladlad, which means coming out. They will definitely win one seat. First elected LGBT representative in the world on a purely LGBT ticket at a national level.
One question, are they identifying themselves as an LGBT ticket?
LGBT.
That's their phrase.
LGBT. Okay. Very much so. This is part of my story. and the woman who will go to Congress definitely is a transgender woman who calls herself transgender, and she is a woman. Her name is Bems Benedito. She's very impressive. Watch the space. She's going places. There may well be two gay men who will also get elected alongside her, but she'll definitely get elected. Now, in the Philippines, there's this category called bakla, which, for those of you who know Southeast Asia, is kind of equivalent to what you would call waria in Indonesia, or Katwi in Thailand. I forget the term in Malaysia, but there's a similar term in Malaysia. Now, I am Bakla. Daniel is Bakla.
I beg your pardon.
But so is somebody who has breasts and may or may not have a penis and wears women's clothing. It's a fluid continuum. And we are all Bakla. And we can choose where in that continuum we want to put ourselves.
Wait, when you say we are all Bakla...
We are all Bakla, excuse me.
Who is we?
You're quite, thank you. Anybody who... But this is what's interesting. It mixes up sexuality and gender.
Uh-huh.
Anybody who is non-normative in terms of their gender, any male who is non-normative in terms of his/her gender, and any male who is non-heteronormative in terms of his sexual behavior is Bakla. But now there are these categories, LGBT, and the T's as the Bakla at the one end of the continuum, who have access to the internet and have access to an international human rights community, are beginning to understand themselves as women. They're women. They're not a third gender or some mix-up of genders. They are women, and it's very important for them to be recognized and identified as women, whether or not they carry male genitals. And the LGBT organization in the Philippines, a really dynamic organization called STRAP, has an agenda of helping young Bakla pass through their false consciousness of thinking that they're Bakla and accept themselves as women. This is going to have a profound impact on Filipino society. Let's not judge it. Let's not put a value judgment on it. But things are changing. I could give a similar example in India. Should I?
Sure.
Yeah. So, you know, India has for one might say millennia had a culture of so-called eunuchs, of hijras, a separate caste of people who, possibly because they are gender non-conforming, or possibly for other reasons that have to do with complicated social stuff, kind of leave their heterosexual home communities and join an alternative community of hijras or eunuchs where they form these alternative sets of relationships in a system called a jamaat system, because you've basically been cast out of your family because you're gender non-conforming and you can't rely on the state, you are looked after by an older hijra who becomes your guru, you are her chela. And there's this whole alternate structure which sets up, which accommodates hijras who cannot go to their families anymore. But part of being a hijra means ultimately getting castrated.
Getting castrated.
And presenting in a very particular way as a woman publicly. And I'm sure you've all seen films about hijras. Now, some really interesting things are happening in India around this. The first thing that's happening is a human rights movement, which again is enabling more middle-class transgender people to understand themselves as transgender rather than hetero, but also as people who can claim rights on the basis of their gender non-normativity. So there's a whole human rights movement which has emerged, particularly in the south of India, which is providing a severe threat to the Jamaat system. Because as you realize that you can kind of be yourself and practice your personal autonomy as a transgender person, you're going to think about things you could do other than sex work and begging and giving everything you earn from sex work and begging to a mean older hijra who's going to beat you up anyway. So a bunch of younger transgender people are defining themselves outside of the Jamaat system and are sort of striking off on their own. The result of which is that this has been researched by a really interesting organization in Bangalore, a kind of spike in transgender suicides. Because you're no longer in one community, the Jamaat system, but you're kind of alone in society. Your family hasn't reaccepted you back either. So I, while I was in India, because I'm interested in global flows, I'm really interested in the role that the multinational corporations are playing in countries like India and the Philippines, specifically the business processing organizations, the call centers, which are known to be sort of hotbeds of homosexualism. And in the Philippines, it's a particularly interesting story, less so in India, because, you know, when you're at a call center talking to somebody in the United States, if you want to be she rather than he and you have a female voice, you can actually live out your life as a female. But I interviewed several transgender women who got jobs in the call centers, and none of them have been able to keep their jobs, and they're kind of in this limbo phase. The society is not yet accepting of them as transgender people now that they have left. Because in the hijra system, you will find many middle class people who may even have gone all the way to university, but because they are cast out by their families and can't get jobs, they land up working in sex work and begging anyway.
I mean, what you're describing in a way reminds me of accounts of the emergence of gay identity sort of as people were aggregated in urban centers and freed from the confines of their family. In a way, the Jamaat system just sounds like another proxy family, right?
Absolutely.
I guess, so that brings us to, because this is pretty out there for OSF, like we're not necessarily spending a lot of time in like gender variance and things, and much more of our work is often focused on rights, power, and sort of flows of people and politics. So two questions with regard to that. One is actually about international power and money, something that we are quite interested in. You know, I have been present at in a number of countries where faxes or emails arrive from Hillary Clinton's office advising, for example, the Vietnamese foreign ministry to please articulate and advise on their policy toward gay marriage. There was also, you know, the famous UK conditionality discussions around aid to, say, the homophobic Ugandan state and sort of what countries needed to pledge to do or not to do prior to receiving support. What do you think about this exercise of, you know, blue team power, but as expressed by a sort of money and politics? Like, how do you think it will play out? What are you for it? Are you against it?
It's so complicated. Let's look at the example of Malawi, and my colleague Ian Sadiswats is here, which is wonderful, and I hope Ian, because Ian runs LGBT programming for Southern Africa out of Johannesburg, for those who don't know him. So he might have some things to say about this, too. In fact,
I should hope so.
He will have some things to say. You know, I'll tell you the Malawi story very quickly, and correct me if I've made some mistakes in it, Ian, because I think it's very emblematic of a whole lot of dynamics. So there's these signals that are in the atmosphere that basically neither we nor the red team have any control over. You know, it's Facebook, it's Grindr, which is one of the big gay hookup sites, it's Will and Grace, it's...
Are Grindr and Will and Grace internationally?
Will and Grace, certainly. I wouldn't know about Grindr.
Nor would I.
It's South African sitcoms, every single one of which has a gay character and an empowered gay character. It's news that same-sex people can get married in countries like South Africa or in countries like Britain. And that this intelligence permeates, whether you like it or not. So there's a couple living, it's a very working-class, ordinary couple living in Malawi, who one of whom is a man and the other one of whom identifies as a woman but is male-born biologically. And they decide, well, you know, let's get married. And the way they decide to do it is they decide they're going to appropriate traditional customs around engagement that from Malawi. I forget the actual ethnic group. And Chichewa, right? Chichewa. And they hold this engagement ceremony, having got the idea, not part of any rights movement. They hold this engagement ceremony, and the media finds out about it, and hey, it's a great story. I mean, who wouldn't cover it? So the media goes and covers it in a relatively non-judgmental way. Relatively non-judgmental way, the media covers it. As a result of which, somebody wakes up in the criminal justice system and says, hey, we have a law forbidding this kind of thing. This is not allowed in our society. So these two people are arrested. They're sentenced to something like 14 years imprisonment. And as a result of which, and thrown into jail, terrible circumstances, really, really quite brutal. You can imagine their inmates in jail weren't so pleased with them. There's a global solidarity campaign that has a whole lot of different permutations.
Were they both put in the mill side of the...
I don't know, yeah.
Stephen was, but Tiwonge, which is a female name, there was a negotiation between OSF and the prison authorities, and Tiwonge ended up in the VIP jail, which is a new concept for us too.
It's not new for us here in the US.
Which came with its own challenges, because in the VIP jail you don't get fed. So we managed to move Tiwonge from the male prison population, where she was really in great danger. But then we had to put other measures in place to make sure that she had, you know, 3 daily meals, etc., etc.
But I mean, note Anne's use of the word "we," and yeah, thank God for you. And whether it was the work that Anne was doing, or the work that Soros's economic advisors were doing, when they went and had later one-on-one meetings with the new Malawian government. There was, I mean, that was later. Sorry, I should put this into a continuum. So the kind of advocacy that happened around that time, a key part of that advocacy was that Malawi is signatory to, or Malawi receives some aid that comes directly from the U.S. Congress, and there are governance conditions attached to that aid, and through some sort of dialogue between activists in Washington, D.C., and Malawian LGBT activists on the ground, it was seen that this could be used as a lever to get these people released, and it was very effectively used as a lever. These two people were released. Chiwenga, Stephen decided, I think after they were in jail for, 18 months?
Yeah.
Stephen decided to stay in Malawi. Chiwenga has now received asylum on the basis of her transgender identity in South Africa. And that story ended happily. The president died. There's a new president, Joyce Banda, who has been very explicit. And it was with Joyce Banda that George Soros' advisors went to meet to talk about aid and democracy, of course. And Joyce Banda has been very proactive about changing Malawian law. Now, both the activists in Malawi have been very smart in that they're not single issue, but that's a whole other story because there's a whole lot of laws in Malawi that need to change. But the point is that the activism has been very effective. And the activism from Washington down, you know, through to the OSF, through to activism by local Malawian LGBT people and their allies. But this cannot but promote, all of this cannot but promote a discourse which says that this is a Western agenda. And breaking that deadlock is very difficult. And one of the things I really respect about the OSF LGBTI rights program is that it's actively looking for ways of breaking that deadlock by promoting African narratives, by finding ways to enable African people or to help or to support African people as they tell their own stories, so that these interventions are seen less and less to be interventions of a West imposing its neo-colonial, neoliberal agenda on people whose cultural sovereignty and traditional values are being trampled upon yet again by the United States. Now, it doesn't help when a kind of cack-handed official at the Pakistani American embassy decides to host the first ever Pakistani LGBT pride in Islamabad, like not weeks after Osama bin Laden was assassinated.
You mean the American embassy employee.
State official, embassy employee, decides to host LGBT pride, following a directive that came from, you know, from Washington.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think he was interpreting that directive in a particularly savvy way. And the effect on the LGBT activists in Pakistan was very negative. As you can imagine. I mean, this is the last thing they need.
Okay, I'm going to stop you there because there is much expertise in the room and because we want to have time for questions and things. I think let's just open it up. And I'll take the first question from Dave Scammell. And if you could, again, for those who came late, if you wouldn't mind just explaining what program you work with so that the rest of the room can get a sense.
So I'm Dave Scammell with the Central Health and Rights Project, and I just actually wanted to add a sort of a nuance to the Malawi example, and particularly at the global level, it was positioned as a gay marriage issue. And the advocacy was very targeted towards it being gay marriage and trying to get support from sort of global actors and international LGBT movement was very much around positioning it in that way and ignoring the fact that this wasn't specifically around two men. It was actually an issue of a trans woman and her partner being denied the right to marry. And so it's just interesting how that those forces then sort of played back into the country and then shaped the discourse in that way.
No, and that's an interesting point because, of course... Oh, so for those, I don't know if you guys could hear, but Dave was making... Did you hear? No? Okay.
No, please repeat the question.
Sure. It was more of a statement than a question. It was just pointing out that the way that the narrative played out internationally about the Malawi case was one of gay marriage rather than a marriage between a trans woman and her partner. And I think Dave's implication was that the gay marriage frame, which is actually familiar to us, for example, in the U.S., and which, though he didn't say this, Hillary Clinton's constituents are particularly invested in, etc., that the gay marriage story kind of overshadowed the trans issues, which were probably the way the people in question would have framed it. So I want to...
Can I just respond to that?
Yes.
I mean, let me complicate that a little bit further, Dave. But, okay, I've interviewed Chiwonga.
Yeah.
And it's clear to me that Stephen and Chiwonga got the idea to do this because they had been reading about gay marriage. Mm-hmm. And this is my point about the continuum.
Can you face the microphone?
Oh,
sorry.
So, yeah.
Don't face your question.
Is this some kind of counterterrorism strategy?
I have children.
So this is complicated because there's a movement in the LGBT movement to really understand T as something separate from LGB. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But people often understand it themselves as a continuum. And that's not necessarily because they have false consciousness, as the good activists of Strap in Manila might believe. There is a continuum between sexual orientation identity and gender identity that is very complicated and is not as simple as we might like to believe it is. But nonetheless, I think that you're absolutely right, that one needs to understand it outside of our narrow frame about gay marriage.
So I want to give our colleagues in London and DC, because you are most distant from us physically, I wanted to give you the first chance to ask a question if you had any. You're not required to have any.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. From the Global Drug Policy Program here in London. Thanks a lot, Mark. I don't know if this question is too self-serving or off base, and I withdraw it if you don't want to deal with it, but it's of interest to me that so much has happened around LGBT rights in not only in the UN, but in the particular confines of the Human Rights Council. And I think especially the effective use of the Universal Periodic Review, which
right.
is a more public kind of process than the old treaty body processes and so on. Whereas many of us have been laboring around issues where we think there might be a parallel to LGBT, such as the rights of people who use drugs or have drug addictions, and not getting that kind of traction, I wonder if you know how strategically it came about that the movement such as it is decided to try to use the Human Rights Council and UPR in particular, and what it is about the effort that has managed to mobilize the blue states, as you put it, where we haven't on other issues with a, if you like, cultural dimension, have not had that kind of success.
I think it's, thank you. I think it's a very good question, and it's worth pondering, and I would invite others around this room to share their thoughts on it too. I think it's a combination of things. I think it's the result in part of an extraordinarily effective NGO based in Geneva called ARC International, ARC International, and I urge you all to go to their website. And the really smart way they've managed to lobby the missions, but also mobilize the NGO community. That's one. I think the big story, though, is the United States, Susan Rice, and Hillary Clinton. And the decision by the State Department to lead on this particular issue. And we can talk about why that is. We can talk about whether that was because there's a domestic agenda, and this fitted in really well with the domestic agenda. We can talk about whether certain individuals saw this as a legacy issue, and after taking some sort of tentative steps, saw how well it was serving them politically, how much kudos they were getting. And we could also talk about very effective operators in the State Department And I'd like to mention specifically a man named Dan Baer, who is an Assistant Secretary of State who has responsibility for LGBT issues and is the highest ranking LGBT person in the Department of State, B-A-E-R, and the work that he did. I think it's all of those things. So let me just give you a minute on the story of how this resolution came about, which is that South Africa had, in fact, initially proposed a real shilly-shallying, wishy-washy resolution because it was trying to position itself as the kind of the spokesperson for the African states. So South Africa had proposed a resolution saying we need more dialogue on this matter. It's unclear. And basically, there were two groups of people who put a lot of pressure on South Africa to change its position. The one was a group of human rights advocates within South Africa who sought and obtained meetings with South African officials up to the highest level, saying, you know, we have this in our constitution. What do you mean we need more dialogue on this? It's like, we have same-sex marriage in this country. No more dialogue is necessary. Goddammit. And they were heard. But there is no question that I know this from interviews, that the Americans in New York and in Geneva did some serious arm twisting and said to South Africa, look, you know, you are one of the countries in the global south that is a leader here. If you want to be part of a global club of human rights, you've got to be part of this. And there might have been some other discussions, like South Africa has, this is conjecture. This is pure conjecture. But South Africa has aspirations to be permanently on the UN Security Council. I don't know what Susan Rice was promising the South Africans in terms of support, but South Africa did a 180-degree volte-face. And when you speak to the South Africans and you speak to other people in Geneva, American pressure had a lot to do with it.
So since Ian is with us, I wanted to give him a chance to talk about any issues raised, but obviously a lot intersects with your own portfolio. So,
just to add to Mark's last point, I do think that the South African activists were really good at naming and shaming back home, which is probably another reason why there was this dramatic turnaround in the local stance of the South African government. It was very interesting that last year when we met with the South African mission in Geneva, for instance, around transgender health for people migrating from their countries into South Africa because it's safer and they can actually access services, it was the first time that South Africa engaged in the conversation about providing health services to transgender people from other countries in the region. So it's clearly a conversation that's moving forward. I just want to come back to the Stephen and Tuwonge issue quickly because it shows how very rapidly things move. Stephen and Tuwonge had lived as a couple in this village for many years. Everyone knew that Tuwonge was female-bodied, very well-respected, had a good job, was supported by their families and their communities. And all of that changed overnight when they were identified as two gay men rather than what they were. And I think they too didn't really have the language to set that right. It's today that Tuwonge identifies very comfortably as a transgender woman, but at the time of her arrest, she didn't have that language.
What language did she have?
There was no language. I mean, there's the traditional language that that's being used that truthfully isn't probably the most affirming language that there is, but that is all she had. And the truth is that in her community, things were fine. So it was only once there was this great interest from the media and they became two gay men and government was interested. And when we went back to talk to the village elders, because we weren't quite sure, Tuwonge had first tried for Canadian status, for refugee status in Canada before South Africa. And when we thought that Canada wasn't going to happen and we weren't quite sure where Tuwonge was going to go, we tried to see what the possibility was of getting integrated back into a community. And it was amazing how once you use the local languages, the vernacular, then how community leaders were much more acceptive of their whole idea. But two gay men was clearly a Western idea that was foreign to them. While Tumonge, as she had lived all her life as a woman, dressed as a woman, named the youth Tumonge, the name Tumonge, which is a female name, that to them was much more acceptable. And so I do think sometimes it has to do with how issues are packaged and how very wrong the media, both domestically and internationally, can get it sometimes. I mean, I think it was a missed opportunity for us because we had the choice when we were sitting and drafting the legal strategy for the lawyers that were presenting Stephen and Tumonge in court. There was the question, are we going to introduce transgender issues into a Malawian court? And the room was as many people as we have in this room, and everyone gave us a blank stare because transgender issues had absolutely no meaning. So it was very clear that with the timeline that we had, it made no sense sort of introducing it, but I still think it was a missed opportunity.
Can I say something about that not having language?
Sure.
So let me give you another example, which I find very interesting. And this is why the language is so important and why LGBT is so important, despite all the kind of cautionary notes I've given. So there's a really really wonderful, I'm not sure whether they're grantees, they might be, organization at Makerere University in Uganda called the Refugee Law Project.
Correct.
They are grantees. Okay. And they provide assistance to refugees seeking asylum in Uganda, and Uganda is a transitional place to other countries and has a huge refugee population coming from the kind of war-torn areas to its west and to its north. And the officials at the Refugee Law Project noticed that there was a significant number of people coming in who were gender non-conforming, and who, when you listen to their narratives, because seeking asylum is all about storytelling, of course, telling the story of your life, it was clear that the reason, or the primary reason why they had to flee, was because they were gender non-conforming, or that was a key part of what they were fleeing from, particularly in areas where sexual violence was a significant consequence of political destabilization, or tool for political destabilization. And the caseworkers started talking to this group about trying to understand themselves as transgender. And that was strategic.
Right.
It was because you can get asylum in Canada or South Africa or the United States if you're transgender. But something really interesting happened to this group in the process is that people who did not have a collective identity on the basis of their gender non-normativity and who understand their gender non-normativity solely through the word sex worker developed identities as transgender people. And have formed a really strong affinity group at the Refugee Law Project called the Angels. And with that has come not only the possibility of resettlement, but also, according, I have not yet been to Uganda on my travels, so I haven't yet done these interviews, but according to the caseworkers, a much stronger sense of self in the world. So I think that's an interesting story.
No, and I mean, to a certain extent, Ian's story, or the story you just told, is the story of politicization generally. Like, it's the narrative, everything was fine, but as long as it wasn't articulated, and then someone came along and messed it up, and then we had to, this is a familiar story for many political groups and identities. Okay, so I know that there was a question over here. And
I do. Hi, I'm Betsy Apple from the Justice Initiative. Thanks so much. I'm sorry I entered late, so you may have addressed this already, but I'm interested in not only the ways in which the media or the international community comes in and has an impact, but the ways in which the movement itself, as it's currently configured, has an impact.
And we talk about an LGBT or an LGBTI or an LGBTQQII or the alphabet soup, as some people have described it, of the movement or movements. And I'm curious to know if you can project out a little bit based on your experience, where is this all going, given the fact that it started with LGBT, and now it seems to be this, it's expanding into a continuum, and we may not have the initials. So I'm curious to know your thoughts about that.
And maybe we should take actually a number of questions, because as time gets more compressed, that way you can sort of weave it together. Other questions or comments? Yeah. Sorry. Is that Joanne or someone?
DC.
DC. Hi, DC.
Hi, this is Giselle with the LGBTI Rights Initiative in DC. I'm just wondering if, Mark, if you can speak a little bit about pinkwashing. It was explained in the email that was sent out, and we haven't heard about that yet, so maybe you could talk about that.
Okay, and one more question here.
So my name is Livia. I work in the fellowships program, but I used to work for UNHCR, and I've interviewed Senegalese, I've interviewed Ugandan, all with gay men, and some transgenders, but especially in the Middle East and in East Africa, we always interviewed a lot of intersex individuals. It's very prevalent, a lot of intermarriage. And I know that, and it kind of plays off of the question with the alphabet soup, but do we sometimes leave off that I because it's so much more understandable that this is a genetic thing, that, oh, this poor child had nothing to do with it? Because even amongst the Somali population, people were like, no, this is normal, you know, it's not his fault. Whereas we still look at being lesbian or gay or transgender to some degree as a choice.
Okay, so we have the where's this all going? And with particular attention to the initials at the end of LGBT, I, QQI, whatever. And we also have the pinkwashing.
So
an Israel question that we're tantalized with in the email, and we're not leaving until we hear about it.
Let's start with pinkwashing. I attended a conference last week, which was called Homo Nationalism and Pinkwashing, and was organized by the Center for Lesbian and Gay Studies at CUNY, and functioned in several ways. But one of the ways it functioned was as a kind of rallying cry for the sort of nascent Palestinian queer movement, and for the boycott, divest, and sanctions movement, the global boycott, divest, and sanctions against Israel movement. And pinkwashing is a term that has been developed as part of that movement to explain Israel, a strategy that Israel is quite clearly, and the evidence is absolutely clear, that the Israeli state is adopting to brand itself as LGBT friendly by funding programming that involves LGBT agendas and people, so as to say, look how democratic we are. We are a beacon of civilization and human rights and democracy in the Middle East, compared to these homophobic savages just across the border. And that campaign has been called, or that project has been called pinkwashing by its opponents, because it pinkwashes Israel's real human rights record. And it comes from the term greenwashing, the way some corporations kind of do stupid carbon footprint things to greenwash the fact that they're killing the environment. So that's the root of it. And it's very powerful and very interesting. And it's a concept. I suppose my understanding of it is complicated and has been complicated by the research I've been doing. And I'm on my way to Palestine and Israel, so I'll report back in my next brown bag in more detail by a couple of things. Firstly,
you only get one brown bag.
Firstly, well, there are two things that I think are interesting to spool out from that. The first is that there has been a very effective, progressive progressive, within the Israeli context, LGBT rights initiative, a movement in Israel that has fought for these rights and won these rights, and has had to fight for these rights within the Israeli context, and sort of sticking within the borders of 1948. And the Israeli state and its publicity agents, such as AIPAC, are piggybacking on that campaign, on those successes, which I think puts both Israeli and Palestinian queer people in a very difficult situation. And the way it puts Palestinian queer people in a difficult situation is, I think, worth exploring further. There's a very interesting Palestinian queer rights movement which has emerged and which is, I understand, also OSF grantees, and particularly a movement, an organization called Al-Qaws, which means the rainbow in Arabic. And Al-Qaws has a couple of really strong positions. And one of its very strong positions is that it is first and foremost a member of the Palestinian Liberation Movement. And it's dealing with national identity before sexual identity. And that's very familiar to me as a South African. We had that moment too. But they also have a really interesting critique on the things we've been talking about, on the on different modes of sexual identity and what sexuality and gender identity means in different societies. And I think because LGBT has been used so sharply against their people, they have a particularly sharp reading of how the paradigm, the sexual identity paradigm, might not be appropriate in a non-Western, and in their instance, specifically a Palestinian or Arab context. And that critique is very interesting, and I think very important, but also potentially quite limiting, because it doesn't necessarily, and this is a question I have rather than an analysis I have, take into account. So what that analysis says is, like, we don't come out. We stay with our families, we stay with our liberation movements. We're queer, and we need to find ways of integrating our queerness into all our other identities, because, like, Tel Aviv is not an option for us, right? But what that doesn't necessarily take into account is that Tel Aviv might not be an easy option or a comfortable option, but it's there. And the signals that are sent from Tel Aviv are received in Ramallah and in Jenin and in Jericho. And there are LGBT people who want to act on their LGBT identities in those places. And this is a dynamic that is, I think, really important to understand globally. That I was at a conference in ILGA, which is International Lesbian and Gay Association conference, in ILGA Europe conference in Dublin last year. And I was really struck by the speakers from the former Soviet Union, where, as you know, there is a lot of trouble using these anti-propaganda laws as a way of, as part of a general campaigns against democracy, as ways of controlling LGBT activism. And one of the things that all the activists said is that, well, not all of them, but I thought the sharpest ones, and I'm thinking specifically of a brilliant young woman from the Ukraine who's also one of your grantees. She said, you know, the problem is that society is just moving more quickly than we can handle, than we as activists can handle. We're playing catch up with what our constituents want and need. And in a way, that's a little bit of the Stephen and Chiwonga story. Mm. You know, there's nobody saying, go slowly, we need to do this and do that. Well, the message of saying, go slowly, we need to sort of first put this in place. You know, somebody from Serbia said to me, you know, I started off as a rights advocacy organization, and I'm now a social worker, because I told all these kids to come out, and they've come out, and they've been chucked out of their homes. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's, sorry, a long and a way of avoiding the intersex question.
But now the time has come. And it wasn't just about intersex.
No, no, but it's about the soup.
The soup, and also this question of whether or not it's useful or necessary to call out identities when better left alone.
I'm still struggling with these questions myself, and I can't begin to give strong strong opinions or advice on them. I mean, I use the word sexual minorities rather than LGBTQIQQQ. But that's using a very liberal democratic notion of what a minority is. And it's a notion that comes out of, why do queers have power in the United States? It's because they constituted themselves as a political minority, and this is a system that works by cobbling together coalitions of whole bunches of minorities so that you can get elected. And that doesn't necessarily work in countries that don't work democratically the way the United States works. I'm uncomfortable with the LGBTQ thing.
Well, Q, just for clarity, can sometimes mean queer and sometimes mean questioning. And I mean, that's
yeah. But what I think is interesting about the way the alphabet soup expands is the way it becomes a reductio ad absurdum, which I actually think is quite useful. So you know, so I was at this pinkwashing conference. I was in a seminar where we all had to introduce ourselves, and as is the norm now, we had to say what our names were and what pronouns we would like to be used. So I said, I'm Mark, he. Somebody else said her name, she. Somebody else said his name, he.
They.
Then somebody else said their name, they. And then somebody else said, and I don't know whether he, she, they was being ironic or not, but he, she, they said, my name is Nomad, he, she, they. It's like... and part of me was like, this is not helpful. Tell me what you want me to call you and I'll call you that. And part of me was like, right, you're showing me how stupid this all is, in a way.
I taught a class in a place where people were it.
I mean, you know, and they is quite a common, even though to me, sort of old school, if someone who wants to be called they, it sounds like you're more than one person, and that is supposedly... like from where I'm used to standing, that's not good. But clearly, like, people wish to exercise these choices in different ways.
So to your intersex question, I mean, I think you raise a really... I'm not actually, even though it says that I'm doing LGBTI, in my own work, I'm not doing I.
Yeah, I noticed it was missing from everything.
Yeah. And
but you got the fellowship with the I.
I suppose it's the way those LGBTIs are defined is that, I mean, on the one hand, you've got what you heard from Somalis saying, this is something you're born with, this is a biomedical condition, so it's kind of outside of stigmatization. But I suppose the way the eyes have become part of the soup is by the way that they have shown how they are stigmatized and how they're often stigmatized using the labels that are applied to LGBs and Ts. And I'm thinking specifically of the example of Caster Semenya in South Africa, who was accused of being a man. And you know,
can
that
you say who she was for those of us who don't
know? Oh, Caster Semenya was the extraordinary South African athlete who was disqualified from participating in international athletics because she had too much testosterone. According to the test, she identifies as a woman, but there was a whole discourse about whether she's transgender, female, or intersexed, and it appears that she is intersexed, but that she identifies as a woman, but she was struggling with what... in a spectrum, what LGBT people struggle with. So it makes sense to understand her as a sexual minority in that way. But I think it's really growing. I mean, I think understanding of intersex is growing as intersex advocates find their voices within the LGBTI movement.
I mean, I is enormous. Because
yeah.
You can have three chromosomes.
Yeah.
You can have just a variety of different hormonal issues. I mean, it's not, it's its own
There's all these subsets within that.
And, you know, just not to send us too far in that direction, but, I mean, in the U.S., the Intersex Society of North America kind of had made a strategic decision actually to retreat a little bit from the LGBTI frame and to go toward a more medicalized frame and started identifying, in some cases, as people born with intersex condition in an explicit appeal to the kinds of things you're talking about, as opposed to an identitarian sort of political organizing frame. And obviously people, again, different people who are intersex may make different choices about how they want to affiliate. So other questions and thoughts? And I realize I've had my back to some of you, so I apologize if there are questions here that haven't been answered.
I have one question to add another level to this. Mark, Felix, in the documentary photography project, Moving Walls, what about the asexuals?
Mm-hmm. So for those who might not have heard, Felix added the question, what about asexuals?
Felix, what about them?
Exactly. Well, I'm a friend of a director of the documentary called Asexual. And the main character in the film is an activist who basically, along with the movement, the asexual movement, has been in some ways trying to align themselves with LGBT, become part of the alphabet. So I was just wondering, like, if you had any thoughts on, or has it been part of your studies or your research? Not at all.
Well, no.
It's on
Netflix.
Speak
to the microphone,
yeah. It hasn't. I mean, I'm aware that there's an asexual movement, and I'm aware that there is a movement to put A into the sort of chain of letters. I suppose what I'm looking at is how people. No. I'm looking at how what the connection is between identity and rights, and I don't think there is enough of an asexual rights movement globally for it to come onto my radar.
Other questions?
Can I just add something to that
pink
question?
Please.
But
only if you like them.
I'm Richard Kim. I'm the executive editor of The Nation, and I'm calling you Mark. So I was on the first LGBT delegation to Palestine last year, which Mark and I exchanged stories about.
We're all waiting for the documentary, which seems to be
right
still in process.
Oh, really? So you know, as I was leaving Israel, I was in Tel Aviv. And it had just been announced that the city had been named the best LGBT city in the world by some like travel website. And then like within like 3 hours, there was like a parade in downtown Tel Aviv, impromptu sort of gay pride parade. And then later, when I was leaving the country and was detained in security for a very long period of time, they asked me what I was doing there, and the border agent was like, oh, do you know that we want this for like the best LGBT? So I just say that to say that like it's clear that pinkwashing is kind of a real thing, and that it names a set of state and economic activities that are invested in tourism and also the promotion of a certain kind of Israel. At the same time, you know, I think the term is a dangerous one when it is used beyond that to name and shame like any sort of self-pride and interest in gay rights in Israel. A lot of Israelis I met also, you know, tell this story of, which is one of democratic yearning, right? That this is a society that we created and we were excluded, and then we sort of mobilized these institutions and identities and got these rights. And that's true. And where that sort of democratic yearning goes, I think, is a very open question, and mm-hmm. could also extend past the green line, or it could not. And so, you know, to me, the term is useful when it names a very concrete set of state and economic activities, and not when it's used sort of indiscriminately.
I think you're saying much more articulately what I was trying to say, which is that one needs to understand the internal dynamics of a movement and of a democratizing society within Israel, together with the state policy, and not throw the baby out with the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, there was at this Homo Nationalism conference I was attending. Pinkwashing was sort of used metaphorically to describe movements in other countries. So we heard about pinkwashing in the Nordic countries. We heard about rainbow washing in South Africa. These various ways. I mean, you could speak about how the United States is involved in a pinkwashing project as well, with the foreign policy objectives. But what was worrying to me is what Richard has just articulated, is that it has the effect of negating the advocacy of human rights defenders in these environments. When one understands the state, when the state as actor overpowers civil society as actor. Was seen to overpower civil society as actor.
Thanks. So, any other questions? And if not, I mean, we only have about 5 minutes left. I will ask you, just as a teaser, before the next brown bag, to reflect a little bit, since you mentioned it, on thoughts. And I know this is always a sort of dangerous way to end, but particularly around the boycott, divestment, sanction. Arguments, given that you are a South African and that strategy is actually, obviously, I mean, the Richard said he was part of the first LGBT delegation. Of course, there was another famous visit by South Africans to look at some of these pinkwashing questions, and a lot of this discussion around boycott or divestment has been very infused with South African opinions or insights, and just curious for your own.
So I've made the decision not to come out as personally, not to come out as a supporter of the BDS movement until I go to Palestine myself. And that's a kind of personal, ethical decision I've made.
Mm-hmm.
But what I do know is that, I mean, and I'm also, I get very angry with people who get angry with the word apartheid used to describe Israel, because it's so clearly appropriate. And it's absolutely clear.
We like to end on a soft note.
A good door knob.
You asked the question.
Well, our time is up. No, sorry.
No, there's no question that the sanctions movement was a very significant part. Oh, so what I was going to say is while I get angry about that, and sorry, that was personal, because I'm thinking of people in my family. I'm Jewish as well. I'm very cautious about making direct comparisons between Israel, Palestine, and South Africa. They're very different places at very different times. They're very different places at very different places. But there's no question that the boycott, sanction, divestment strategy played a very significant role in moving South Africa towards democracy. And the way it played that role was because over the course of the 1980s, white South Africans got to see that the cost was too high. So they did a cost-benefit analysis and realized that something had to shift. And there were many triggers. Partly was the increased violence, increased militarization, more and more kids dying on the borders defending the war, but also the fact that you couldn't watch the sport you wanted to watch, you couldn't see the culture you wanted to see, and the South African economy was really beginning to suffer, particularly after the Comprehensive Anti-Apartheid Act was passed here in the United States in 1987, I think. And South Africa lost its credit rating in a whole lot of banks. Now, I don't, like, for me, boycott, divestment, sanctions strategy is only going to work in Israel if Israelis are receptive to those messages. And
if, in fact, there's enough I mean, pool. Setting aside the question of whether I think it's a good idea, whether enough people are doing it for that, for the messages to even be relevant.
But even if enough people were doing it for the messages to be relevant, would they be heard? And I mean, the evidence is not great on that score at the moment. I mean, what Israel seems to be sort of in a kind of suicidal mode that I find difficult to understand, and that white South Africans weren't in. But I don't think I want to say much more before I go.
Okay. Well, we will await the report back. Thank you very much. Obviously, much to think about. I will say also personally that there is not as much discussion of sort of sexuality and gender identity at OSF as at some other places I have been. So it's particularly refreshing to hear you talk about it and for us to think about it, and looking forward to the next installment.
Great. Thank you.